6:40. Greetings to all of our Voice of America listeners. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
We begin with some big Olympic news over the weekend. The International Olympic Committee ruled that they will not issue a blanket ban against all Russian athletes from competing in the Rio 2016 Olympic Games. Instead, they're letting governing bodies for individual events make the call. Thomas Bach is president of the International Olympic Committee and explained Sunday who's in, who's out of the Olympics this year.
The international sports federations will carry out an individual analysis of each athlete's anti-doping record, taking into account only reliable international tests. That means Russian tests cannot be taken into consideration. Unlike any other National Olympic Committee, no Russian athlete who has ever had a doping sanction will be accepted in the Olympic Games Rio 2016, even if he or she has served the sanction.
While that means that Russia's track and field athletes will remain banned from the Games after a ruling from the Court of Arbitration of Sport last week, it also means that hundreds of other Russian athletes may still be able to go to Rio, as long as they've never had a doping violation. Among the Russian athletes celebrating the decision, world number 11 tennis player Svetlana Kuznetsova. After the decision, she simply tweeted, "Rio," followed by three Russian flag emojis. Well, joining me now to discuss this ruling and what it means for the Olympic Games is David Larkin, an attorney who focuses on sports law and anti-corruption, and he's been following this doping issue for some time now. Dave, thanks very much for joining us. Walk me through this decision and what this means for the athletes.
Well, what's happened is that we've found ourselves in sort of a bad situation. Historically, back to 2013, there were indications that there were serious problems in Russia with regards to the anti-doping laboratory and with regard to the system for athletes and the athletic culture. Moving forward, what happened is that the Russian monitoring lab and facility for anti-doping failed. Investigations were launched. But basically nothing was done proactively to really set up a monitoring system for Russian athletes for the last 3 years. As a result, we have completely missing data set for Russian athletes over the last 3 years and indications from the outside that something's really, really, really wrong. In that context, the IOC found itself in sort of the middle of a hurricane. They had no data looking backwards as we head towards the Rio Olympics. The anti-doping system had essentially failed with regards to Russia, and so what they were trying to do is make the best of a bad situation. So what they did is essentially try to have individual sports decide on whether the Russian athletes in each of those sports, there's enough reason to believe that they're clean to compete, and that's where we are today.
So how likely is it then that most or even all of Russia's athletes could still be banned just by the individual athletic bodies rather than the IOC writ large?
Well, I think there's a decent chance of that happening. I mean, each sport is now deciding the fate of the Russian athletes. So we could see a significant reduction in the number of athletes from Russia in the Rio Olympics.
So maybe Svetlana Kuznetsova's tweet that she sent out where she's excited about Rio, maybe that might be premature.
Correct.
Well, we're 11 days out from the opening ceremonies for the Rio Olympics. Even if the Russian athletes do get to make it to the games and the individual sports decide they can go, is 11 days enough for them to get out there, or are they going to be caught in kind of a limbo?
Well, they're caught in a very difficult situation. The clean Russian athletes have been really prejudiced here. I know that a lot of people are saying that Russia should be banned. There's a lot of animosity based on the McLaren report, and appropriately so. The question, though, is that the McLaren report, which suggested that something's terribly wrong in Russia and it's really propriety has allegedly occurred, has never solicited input from Russia. So what we have in this environment are allegations that have not been answered or at no opportunity to answer them has been proffered. Worse, we have a failed doping system where clean Russian athletes have essentially no ability and no guidance for the last 3 years on how they're supposed to prove themselves clean. The third terrible thing that's happened is that the Court of Arbitration for Sport, essentially what's happened for Russian athletes is that they are presumed guilty going into court. Moreover, blanket bans are now justified under the IAAF precedent, and there's some other instances. So all of those things have conspired to set us up in a situation that's incredibly terrible, not only in terms of the clean Russian athletes. What should really alarm everyone is that we have now precedent for all of this bizarre and imperfect process to be the standard going forward, so it could victimize athletes of every nation going forward as precedent. And that's why the attorneys in sport law are currently really sounding the alarm bells, while everybody else seems to be looking at us like we're kind of crazy, because we have a process that's gone off the rails.
And so what does Russia do next then, and could their next move that become precedent?
Well, I think Russia now, what's interesting is that Russia has accepted essentially a double jeopardy provision, saying, you know what, the IOC said, look, anybody who served a doping ban at any time, even if you've come out the other side of it, cannot then go to the Rio Olympics. Well, that's contrary to sport law precedent. So that's in conflict. And so we're really in the middle of a storm, and the Russian athletes who are clean are left to fight their way through not only the qualifying for their individual sport through their individual sport governing body, but then also maybe having to face up to CAS and try to untangle all of this mess. We're in the middle of a storm. There's a short period of time, and it's a total, total mess.
And part of that mess, it sounds like, is that each sport may have a different process that they use to clear these athletes. So could we see maybe some athletes having an easier time than others?
It's a great point. We have a lot of sport is governed by what is called natural justice, and it's a junk legal term that has almost no definition. So your point is right on. We could have completely arbitrary, inconsistent processes to clear athletes sport to sport. There's a point to be made that each sport should be individualized in how they clear athletes. For example, if you have missing data for the last year, 3 years, and let's say an athlete cleans up in the last month so that they now test negative, but those 3 years is where they were doping. In the marathon, those 3 years of doping could have a profound effect of how the athlete performs now. But in archery, where really those drugs are likely to be like attention deficit medication to allow athletes to focus, where they have less of an effect on the physical performance. In that sport, if you wash out over the last month, it's unlikely that the playing field is significantly shifted towards the cheating athlete. So it's appropriate to have different standards in different sports. The question is the processes. Procedural inconsistency is what could really be detrimental, and it's why the sport justice system and procedural system, which is so ill-defined and unsophisticated, has got to move forward and change.
So what do you see being the big story coming out of this Olympics? Of course, this doping story has dominated the headlines, but fast forward 3 or 4 weeks from now when the Olympics are wrapping up, are we still talking about this issue, or has something else come up?
The great tragedy to me is that because the global anti-doping system has failed, and it's not just Russia, it's other places, we're always going to have a cloud of suspicion over the performance of athletes, particularly from Russia, in these games. But there's also another thing in play here, and that is that once we get to the competition, these athletes, under the worst of circumstances, are heroes who always make things okay. And that's So we're going to have a mix. We're going to have these great, great athletes who deserve so much credit, mixed with suspicions about anybody who placed ahead of the pack and we don't have a complete doping record for.
And finally, is there one easy fix for this that we can take away from this experience going forward?
Yes, all of this was avoidable. And the thing that we've got to do is we've got to fix the sport justice system, the administrative procedures of sports, for example, IAAF not proactively helping athletes and prescribing a solution to this problem until a month ago when it was far too late. And we need a complete overhaul of the sport justice system. Those three things have to happen. Hopefully, this will be the impetus to do that.
All right, David Larkin, sports attorney focusing on sports law and anti-corruption. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Well, in more Olympic news, Thea LaFond, a star right here in the D.C. area at the University of Maryland, will be making her Olympic debut in Rio de Janeiro, where she'll be representing Dominica in the women's triple jump competition. Thea recently visited our Voice of America headquarters here in Washington and talked with Sonny Young and Ben Cento about her upcoming Olympic experience. Now, over the next week, we're going to hear from Thea as she prepares for the Olympic Games. In part one of her interview with Sonny and Ben, she touched on everything from her Olympic hopes to her home country of Dominica to how she'll deal with the threat of Zika virus. But she starts with how she feels about going to the Olympics for the first time.
It still feels very surreal, but the one word that comes to my heart is just pride, because this is a chance for me to represent, you know, my hard work over how many years and represent my country and represent my little city of Silver Spring and just bring pride to this area and this region and to my family.
Thea, I'm wondering, could you tell our VOA listeners a few things about Dominica, starting with its location?
Well, Dominica is a very tiny island in what is called the Lesser Antilles. The majority of the Caribbean is broken up into two sections, the greater and lesser. Lesser containing more smaller islands. Dominica is located between the tiny islands of Martinique and Guadeloupe. The population is about 72,000 people with about 250 square miles. So we are a very, very small island, but very proud, I assure you.
Thea, what about the local population there in Dominica? How have they responded to you going to your first Olympics?
They have been very supportive, and I'm very happy about that because, to say the least, I have been a little nervous since finding out the news that I will be going. But I thank the people of Dominica for being so supportive of me, and I've really just received nothing but positive news. I mean, people all over Facebook have just reached out and really just shared their warmth, their support, and just their love for the sport and for this massive endeavor.
Thea, on a personal level, how does it feel to represent your home country of Dominica?
Once again, just unreal and just unbelievable amounts of pride. I mean, this is just something every athlete dreams of. So for me to actually be beginning this journey is kind of very exciting for me. I'm looking forward to hopefully putting Dominica on the map since it's so tiny. So many people get us mistaken for Dominican Republic, which we are not. We are not. We don't speak Spanish there. It's not our first tongue. We speak English. And so that's what I'm very excited for.
In terms of putting Dominica on the map, I should let our VOA listeners know that Thea actually showed us where Dominica is located on the map. And great photo, but we'll have to post that on Facebook, Thea, so they can really know where your home country is. At the international level, I know you've been involved in some other international competitions, not just the Olympics. Where have you traveled during your career?
Well, my first competition actually started off in the Caribbean. It was Jamaica, and then ended up going to, I believe it was Barcelona for World Juniors. And then from there, it was unbelievable. Bahamas, Trinidad and Tobago, Tortola, which is in the British Virgin Islands. I've been to Colombia, Medellin. I've been to El Salvador. I have been to all over Spain. It's literally unbelievable. Central America, South America, and Europe is primarily where I've been. And I'm hoping to further that to soon Africa. It's the one continent I'm very eager to touch. Australia, hopefully in the next couple of years, and Asia soon after.
So is this going to be your first time going to Brazil?
Yes, it is. I've only been in Colombia in South America. Medellin is a beautiful city, and I very much so enjoyed it. And Brazil will be my first, you know, major trip there. It will be my longest stay in South America, and I'm really excited. I'm brushing up on my Portuguese already.
Brazil has been preparing to host the Olympic Games while facing more than a few problems on the political level, the economic level, and on the health level, especially the Zika virus, still a big concern, especially for female athletes heading to Rio, like yourself. Do you have any worries about going to Brazil because of Zika?
I think just being a female and knowing that the side effects and precautions needed to take for this trip, I'll definitely keep my eye out for Zika and for all information. A family friend of ours is actually one of the heads of the Pan American Health Organization, and on finding that I am going to Brazil has definitely given me a few heads up about it. I will be traveling with mosquito repellent, as always. But to be honest, when it comes to an event this grand and it being one of the major pinnacles of my life that I've set for myself, while the virus is very worrying, it's not enough to stop this dream. It really isn't. And so it is just a risk that I have to be willing to take, and my fellow athletes have to be willing to take, to kind of live out one of the largest dreams that any athlete can have.
Stay tuned for part two of our interview tomorrow, when Thea talks about the nuts and bolts of the Olympics, including the qualifying process and the events that she'll be competing in.
Voice of America!
Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right, give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively Sunny Man on the Sunny Side of Sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoja here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brilafm.net. I tell you this. It's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
I'm Andrew Balcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Well, there are two new members of the Baseball Hall of Fame today. Ken Griffey Jr. and Mike Piazza were inducted as the Hall's newest members this past weekend. Some stats from our Toddy Abeje. Over his 21-year career, Griffey earned 10 Gold Glove Awards for best defensive player at his position, 7 Silver Slugger Awards for the best offensive player at his position, and was a 13-time Major League Baseball All-Star with over 2,700 hits and 630 home runs. Piazza was a 12-time All-Star, 10-time Silver Slugger Award winner, was the 1993 National League Rookie of the Year, with 2,127 hits and 427 home runs. Impressive numbers for both. Griffey goes into the Hall as a member of the Seattle Mariners, while Piazza is inducted as a member of the New York Mets, where he played 7 of his 15 seasons. Our Jonah Haskell was in Cooperstown for the induction ceremony this weekend and joins us live. Well, Jonah, how is the scene there in Cooperstown, where the Baseball Hall of Fame is located?
Sporty greetings, Andrew. It was great, honestly, because, you know, just to kind of set the scene for you a little bit, Cooperstown is a tiny little town up in the mountains in upstate New York on a lake. During most of the year, it only has a population of around 1,800, so less than 2,000 people live in this town. But every summer, for one weekend, for the Hall of Fame induction weekend, people from all over the country flock to the town. This year, you know, because Griffey was going in as a Mariner, there was a whole contingent of fans that came in from Seattle. Meanwhile, Mike Piazza, who went in as a New York Met, a lot of people drove up from New York City to come see. And then also other people just came from all over the country just to see Cooperstown. And at the induction ceremony on Sunday, there were 50,000 people there on the field watching the induction ceremony. So the population of the town went up 25 times just, you know, for the induction ceremony. And Cooperstown is a tiny little sleepy town. It has one main street with one traffic light in the entire town. And just 50,000 people coming. It was so crowded. There were Hall of Famers everywhere, because also 50 Hall of Famers, you know, who were already in the hall, came to honor the two new Hall of Famers. One night we were eating dinner in a normal little Italian restaurant in town, and in three or four different Hall of Famers came in, as well as Pete Rose, who isn't in the Hall of Fame because he was banned for a betting scandal, but he is the all-time hits leader. So it was, you know, a great atmosphere. There's a lot of energy, a lot of people in town excited to see, you know, two of their biggest heroes get inducted into the Hall.
And they really are heroes for a lot of folks. Now, tell our listeners maybe a little bit more, other than those stats we mentioned about Griffey and Piazza. Who are they? Why are they being inducted, other than those impressive numbers?
One cool thing about Ken Griffey's story is you might have noticed people call him Ken Griffey Jr. That's because his dad, Ken Griffey Sr., was also a great major league player. He isn't a Hall of Famer himself, but he was part of the big Red Machine teams for the Cincinnati Reds in the 1970s, who some people call them the best team that ever played. They won two World Series in 1975 and 1976. And when Griffey was a young little kid, 6-7 years old, he used to hang out in the clubhouse because his dad would bring him in. And, you know, he got to know all these great players, all these Hall of Famers from that Reds team, like Joe Morgan and Mike Schmidt, Gaylord Perry, all those great players. So, you know, that's really cool for Griffey's story. And also, he broke into the majors at an incredibly young age when he was only 19 years old and was just immediately incredibly good. People give him a lot of credit for, they talk about his swing. Ken Griffey Jr. had one of the smoothest swings ever that I've ever seen from the left-handed side of the plate. He made it look almost effortless, you know, just hitting monster home runs way out of the park. And, you know, he likes to wear number 24, which is the reverse of Jackie Robinson's number 42. You know, Jackie Robinson is the first African-American player to play Major League Baseball back in the 50s. And every year MLB does a Jackie Robinson Day celebration where they have all the players wear number 42. And Ken Griffey Jr. was one of the first players to really push for that celebration. And actually, he was named during the induction ceremony as MLB's youth ambassador now. So, you know, people called him the kid when he was young. He was just a fun, you know, fun-loving guy. He liked to joke around with, you know, opposing players, teammates, managers, whoever. So Griffey was just, you know, a real fan favorite, liked to have fun, and also a great player. And, you know, he's number 6 on the all-time home run list. So, you know, that'll tell you just how great he was. And also Griffey lost a lot of time later in his career because of injuries. So, you know, you can think if he hadn't missed 3 or 4 different seasons because of injuries, he may be up there and, you know, 2-3 on the all-time home run list with Babe Ruth and Hank Aaron and those amazing legends.
And over 99% of the vote to get him in the Hall, the highest amount ever. Well, Jonah Haskell, we're going to have to leave it there. We're wrapping up our July 25th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports, but thank you very much, Jonah. Thanks also to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger, VOA engineer Rob McLean, and thank all of you out there in Radio Land for tuning in. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Once the fighting ends, peace treaties are signed and armies are disbanded, the world assumes too often that life in former conflict areas will soon return to normal. But leftover landmines and unexploded munitions stand in the way of post-conflict stabilization and inhibit long-term development. They render thousands of hectares of land unusable and destabilize communities. To mitigate long-term damage and help war-ravaged communities move toward a sustainable peace, the United States has, since 1993, provided over $2.6 billion for conventional weapons destruction programs that help to safely clear landmines and explosive remnants of war, such as ammunition, artillery shells, and air-delivered bombs. Still, in many countries, landmines and unexploded ordnance can kill and maim their victims decades after the original conflict is little more than an ugly memory. Completely ridding former battlegrounds of these explosives is, therefore, a long-term project. This effort cannot succeed without building local expertise in partner nations and training leaders that can take control of mine clearance programs in their own countries. The Center for International Stabilization and Recovery at James Madison University in the state of Virginia has for many years conducted management training for leaders in humanitarian mine action around the world. Since 2010, the State Department's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement has sponsored the course, which seeks to integrate the latest ideas in business management with the practical experience of mine clearance professionals. The goal is to train senior managers of national demining programs to make the programs function more effectively and efficiently. In late spring of this year, the university hosted 21 demining management professionals from Afghanistan, Colombia, Iraq, Laos, Lebanon, Libya, Palau, Senegal, Sri Lanka, Somalia, Tajikistan, Vietnam, and Yemen. They hone their technical and managerial skill, which they will now apply improving their country's capacity to clear contaminated land. The United States is investing in mine and explosives clearance because by doing so, we not only protect civilians from explosive remnants of war, but we also enable lasting peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, men in relationships. What should they do to keep them going and flourish? Join hosts Sande Shomari and his guests discussing men in relationships. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.